So, a great pleasure to welcome again Professor Philip Pettit to give the second UHERO lecture, Robust Demands and the Need for Law.
Very good. Well, again, thank you, Julian. Very nice to be here. Okay, perhaps I should just start by reminding those who are here and informing those who weren't on roughly the ground that I covered yesterday. Let me just get straight into that. I spoke about friendship and about love, for example, and I pointed out that if I seek your care as a friend, then what I seek is not just your care in the actual world, not just that you care for me here and now as things actually are, but I also seek, in general, for most sorts of friendship certainly, I seek your care under variations where it's not so convenient for you to care for me or to be nice to me. If I want you to be a friend, I will want you to care for me even when it's not convenient, up to certain sorts of limits. And equally, I'll want you to care for me even as I change in some respects. So I quote, you know, love is not love, which alters when it alteration finds, is that sort of idea that friendship or love is a good we receive from other people in virtue of their giving us something thinner than love or friendship, call it care. And notice care is what I call a naturalist good or benefit. It doesn't require that things are any old way under other possibilities, under other eventualities or scenarios. It's just here now, I get care. That's terrific. But if I get friendship from you or love from you, then I get something that involves getting care, not just as things actually are, but getting care even if it were less convenient for you, even if I were less charming than I am, or whatever. And I don't enjoy friendship unless, so to speak, you give me that care in that robust way, as I describe it. That's to say, in a way that remains in place even under various changes. So the care has to be available robustly over various changes in you or in me. Okay, so that was the basic idea of a robustly demanding good. It's robustly demanding in the sense that there's a thinner actualist good, a good that's not itself robustly demanding, that has to be given in actual circumstances and in various non-actual circumstances. And we saw that it's not easy to say what are the non-actual circumstances where the care should be available in order for it to count as friendship in this world. There may be no non-circular way of defining it, as with true belief and knowledge. But the thought is, if you understand what friendship is, you know when it's going to remain invariant, when it's going to be steadfast, over what changes in the person there or in you, the beneficiary, you know what sort of variations it ought to be robust over. So it ought to be robust over my making a request for you to help me move an apartment. But it may not be robust over my making a request to help me move a body, as we say. Because when I ask you to move a body, well, suddenly, hey, what sort of guy is this? And in friendship, none of us could expect that. Okay, one thing that's very important to me is that the robustness of care associated with friendship requires that the care is there in various possible scenarios, as I said, and they may not be very probable scenarios. So, for example, in The Importance of Being Earnest, you remember that the main character, well, each of the main two male characters, is really distressed to find that the person who claims to love him and whom he loves, Gwendolyn, in the one case, for example, explains that, oh no, she could never love him if he weren't called Ernest. It gives such assurance, the name Ernest. So the thought is, clearly this isn't love if the woman cares for him only so long as he's called Ernest. Actually, he's called Jack, so it's particularly disturbing for him, as he says, I mean, you couldn't love me if I were called Jack? And she says, oh, no, I should never love a man that was called Jack. It's only Ernest, it's all that I would. You realise this isn't love, and that's the joke of the play in many ways. Okay, so, and then I wanted to generalise that and say that it's not just true of friendship or love or any of these bilateral special virtues, but in general it's true, for example, We enjoy the fact that someone tells us the truth in the actual world, just as things are, but we really savour the honesty of the person, which means that they tell us the truth, not just in the actual world, where perhaps it's convenient and so on, and not troubling, but that they will tell us the truth when it's inconvenient for them to tell us, when it hurts them, or when it's inconvenient for me. That's honesty, that they will speak the truth robustly over those variations. And so that's a robustly demanding good. There's a thin benefit, which is an actualist benefit, doesn't require that things be thus and so outside the actual world, which is truth-telling, and you enjoy honesty insofar as you enjoy truth-telling, the counterpart thinner benefit, robustly, meaning across a range of possible variations. And again, they'll include variations that are not particularly probable. But if the person is honest, they will tell you the truth, even if it costs them thus and so, such and such, even though it might be very unlikely that it would ever cost them such and such. That's what honesty is. It's robust truth-telling. And so on through the various virtues. And what I wanted to argue was that we really savour these goods, these robustly demanding goods, and the way we give them to one another is by being virtuous. And that brought out the point that virtue can serve the good not just in the two traditional ways. The two traditional ways are virtue serves the good by making more likely that you'll do good. That's the one way. And secondly, by making more likely that you'll see what goodness requires. That's the second way, the epistemic way. But apart from all of that, since no amount of doing good or seeing what good requires will give us the robustly demanding goods, we only get them through the very virtue of other people. So the virtues, for example, the virtue associated of loyalty or fidelity with friendship or love, the virtue of honesty, of telling the truth robustly, the virtue equally of justice, of satisfying your claims robustly even when it's not convenient and so on, those are great goods that we enjoy at one another's hands, and we only enjoy them insofar as people are virtuous. Virtue in that way plays a third role over and beyond the instrumental and the epistemic of delivering into our hands what you might call incentive-independent goodwill. That's to say, the person will tell the truth even when the incentives push them against telling the truth. They will remain faithful to you, care for you, even when the incentives push against. And I suggested, though I must say I learned from the exchange and the discussion, which I thought was terrific and helpful for me, a way of putting it is to say that I really care about the will of another person I'm dealing with, whether a special relationship or more generally, and I care about that will, recognizing that even though incentives means the will probably operate in my favour, I realise that as an agent, this person is capable of acting against incentives. And I talked about that being embedded, I'll come back to that later in this lecture, being embedded in the very notion of an agent, that an agent isn't just the plaything of incentives. An agent can do various things that maybe the incentives push against, as it seems to you. So we care about getting some control over that will, but perhaps control is not the best word, and we do that insofar as we find these people are of goodwill towards us. That's what gives us this incentive, independent goodwill towards us, gives us something we really treasure, and only virtue delivers that. Virtue is when someone is of such an incentive, independent goodwill towards us. Okay, now, what I want to talk about today is other actualist benefits. And remember what I mean by an actualist benefit. I come back to that tomorrow, actually, as well. It's a benefit that requires only that things be thus and so in the actual world, just as it is. I want to say there are other actualist benefits which are important to us, and which, moreover, it's really important to us that they are robustly available, not just available in the actual world, but available in various counterfactual scenarios, and where it's not enough that they're delivered by virtue of the goodwill of the other person. See, the ones I was talking about the last day, it's important that the actualist benefits are robustly available, but it's enough that they're available in virtue of the goodwill of the other person who becomes virtuous, a true friend, a true lover, someone really honest, someone really just. That's terrific. But I want to say now there are other actualist benefits where we don't want to even depend on the goodwill of other people. It's not only the case we don't want to depend on the incentives pushing them in the right direction. We don't even want to have to depend on their goodwill in order to get these benefits. And there's a corresponding robustly demanding good which consists in getting that benefit whether or not the person involved, or the people involved around us, are of a goodwill towards us. Getting those benefits in a way that's robust, not just because changes in their incentives to act in certain ways towards us, but even robust across a change in their will towards us, even robust across, for example, a shift in their virtue. Oh, good, there is water. Okay, so let me get straight on to this. I'll come back to some of the points mentioned at the end of that first section in the handout. Well, maybe just to mention this. With these actualist benefits, what we require, therefore, is that they be entrenched in the sense of being made available not just in the actual world, but under various variations. We require that they be entrenched, not just by the goodwill of the other person, but by fences on the will of the other person, by factors, the external constraints on the goodwill of the other person, constraints that, even should their goodwill fail, would push people to deliver the particular benefit, the actualist benefit I'm interested in, across those variations. We want them to be not just internally entrenched, as you might put it, but also externally entrenched. And just one point I may mention before going on. It's very important that with one of these benefits, I don't entrench the availability to me of that benefit just by ensuring that there'll be a reward for you, an incentive for you to deliver the benefit to me. In order to entrench it, because if there's a reward, which you, of course, may refuse for delivering the benefit, if I think of you as an agent, I realize that you're still free to neglect the reward and interfere with me, provide the evil I want to guard against, the actualist evil. And so it's not enough to put in incentives to push you, so to speak, towards behaving properly to me. We want to block, so far as possible, the option of your harming me, so that even should you turn hostile, you find yourself thwarted or obstructed in some way. Thwarted and obstructed are vague words, and I've just mentioned here, and I'm not going to, well, perhaps in discussion we can come back to it, that the sorts of offences, as I call them, that we want to be in place to control the goodwill of others and to make the benefits I'm interested in available across changes will count as, they may be obstacles, actual physical obstacles, they may be costs of various kinds, they may be hurdles in the way of the agent. I'm not going to go into any more detail about what sorts of fences would work. We can come back to that perhaps in discussion. So now, that's all advertising in the way of setting the overall framework. So let me just talk about, first of all, a simple good. It's not a very savoury good, I warn you in advance, that we might seek, which is of this robustly demanding kind, and in particular, a robustly demanding kind that requires external entrenchment, not just entrenchment by the presence of a goodwill in the other person. And that, the unsavoury good I'll use to introduce it, is the good of power. Suppose I've got, I enjoy power over Professor Wedgwood here in front of me. What does that consist in? Well, let's suppose the power is relative to a certain range of choices. I want a power over Rafe in just any old choice, let's suppose, but I've power maybe in a particular domain. That's more plausible. Now, what does it consist in, this power that I might have, this power that I might really want? Well, the actualist benefit that I want, the benefit that I want in the actual world, which does not require that in thing be thus and so in other worlds, under other eventualities, is the benefit of influence. I want his actions, his choices within the relevant domain to track my wishes as to what he should actually do in that domain, to track, in particular, my will, as you might say, in that domain. I want me to influence him, my will to influence what he does. But, of course, here's one way that I could have a lot of influence and even robustly demanding influence on Rafe. Suppose, being a friend of mine, he learns that I've got this passion for power and he decides to humour me. Maybe he thinks it'd be really nice to, you know, keep Philip sort of bouncy and so on. Maybe he'll do his work better, etc., etc. And it really sort of really gives him a lift that he feels he can have power over me, Rafe. And so Rafe humours me. So I want him to do this, he does this. I want him to do that, he does that. Now do I have... So he's got a sort of goodwill, an indulgence certainly towards me, in virtue of which I have influence as things actually are, and did I will that he do something else, that's a change possible, I would have influence then too, because he would be indulgent towards me, let's humor Philip, right? So he'd still let me influence him then. Or over changes in what even he, Rafe, wants to do, well, again, he'll humor me, even if he finds he really doesn't want to do this, but, you know, let's keep Philip happy. And so it's really quite a robust form of influence. But remember, it's a form of influence which is dependent on his will remaining indulgent towards me. Now, I think just as a matter of analysis, I suppose, of what power is, it would be inappropriate, I think, to say that I have power over Rafe. I may think I've got power over Rafe. I may have the trappings, as we say, of power over Rafe. But I don't really have power, because I have this influence over what he does, regardless of what I will that he does, and regardless of what he wills that he does, that's to say, robustly over those possible scenarios, but I have it only by his grace and leave. I have it only by virtue of his indulgence. And you couldn't call that power over Rafe. In order to have power, it has to be the case that it's not dependent on his indulgence. It's not dependent on his will. My influence over him is an influence that is certainly robust over various scenarios, particular scenarios in which my will as to what he should do changes and his will as to what he should do changes. It certainly requires that robust influence, but more strongly, it requires that that robust influence be robust even should he cease to be indulgent towards me. It requires, in other words, that there are some constraints on him, which means that even should he hate the look of me, you know, want anything but to humor me, still the constraints would be in place to make sure that my influence remained robust, that my influence remained in place across those variations in what I want of him, or indeed of what he wants to do. Now, this is the first and primary example to me of a robustly demanding good, the power, corresponding to the thin actualist good influence. It's robustly demanding in the sense it demands that the thin good influence is available, is in place across a range of variations. And in particular, it illustrates that what must entrench the influence across those variations is not Rafe's will, goodwill or indulgence towards me, but is rather some constraints on the will from outside. Now, one thing, of course, immediately worth observing is that the scenarios over which I must have influence robustly in order for me to have power, of course, they won't be all possible scenarios. For example, the scenario in which it turns out that, you know, Rafe, forgive me, Rafe, develops the power of one of these, you know, the Incredible Hulk or whatever, you know. I mean, maybe if, you know, Rafe became the Incredible Hulk, I mean, suddenly my influence would wane. But you wouldn't say that that possible variation, so to speak, is relevant to whether or not I've actually got power. Now, what variations are relevant? Well, I want to say variations in my will as to what he should do and his will as to what he should do. Regardless of what they are, my influence should be in place across relevantly similar scenarios, not across the scenario where he becomes the Incredible Hulk, perhaps, but across a range of scenarios. And when we have a working notion of power, particularly in a given context, we sort of know what the relevant scenarios are, though, of course, there'll be undoubtedly differences on the margins. But the thing that's important is that the scenarios in question may not be particularly probable. So, for example, it may be very improbable, say he's a domain of choice between X and Y, A and B, C and D. It may be extremely improbable that I should want him to do D. I mean, really, really very, very unlikely. It's the last thing on earth I might want. But I don't have power in that domain if in the D scenario, sorry, the scenario where my will is that he should do D, I don't have the influence. So having influence requires not just that, having power requires not just that I have the influence in probable scenarios, but in a range of scenarios, many of which are improbable. And that's the reason, of course, I call it a robustly demanding good. If it were just that it demanded the thin benefit in probable worlds, then when we talk about it, it would not be in any way an interesting sort of case. Okay. Now, having said this about power, and by the way, maybe it's worth looking at the first line of the matrix at the back, which is a sort of summary matrix. Just look at the first line, the third line, strictly, where power occurs at the end in the last column. In the case of power, your choices, now I'm talking to Rafe or whoever my subject is, your choices should match my will over changes in my will and your will, that's to say over changes in what you yourself independently want to do, and over changes in what I want that you should do, over changes in my will as to what you should do, as a result of not just his indulgence, but external constraints, thereby providing for me influence in these various cases, and in providing that influence robustly, providing me actually with power. Okay, now power is not a very savory good, but let me move on to a related good that is much more savory, it seems to me. And I'm just going to define this, because I don't want to get caught up too much in issues of analyzing existing terminology. So I introduce a term. I did actually use it once in an earlier paper. And it's the term anti-power. Now, you might describe anti-power as the power that, or the property that someone has, for example, Rafe, against me, which consists in the fact that he can hold off my power. In that sense, it's anti-power. So what would Rafe's anti-power consist in relation to me? It would consist in the fact he would have anti-power in relation to me, just in case the following is true, that he can influence or shape, let's suppose, because, I mean, have influence, that's just trivial. His anti-power consists in being able to shape his choices over changes in my will and in his will. So in the second person, you have anti-power over me. You would have power over me if you could force me to choose according to your will, regardless of what I willed. You have anti-power in relation to me insofar as you have power over what you choose. You have influence over what you choose, regardless of what you will that you should do, regardless of what your taste is. You can do it. And regardless of what my taste is as to what you should do, regardless of my will. But it's anti-power because it's Rafe's control over Rafe's choices. In the case of power, you're talking about someone's control over someone else's choices. To have power over your own choices, to robustly have a shaping influence on what you choose, independently of what the other relevant person here wills that you should do, and independently of what you should will, that you should do, that is to have anti-power. Now, anti-power is much more savory than power, and here's one reason why. Power is asymmetrically positional. A positional good, you remember, is a good that requires you to have a certain position in relation to other people. Equality is a positional good, but it's a symmetrical positional good because it requires that each is at the same level as others, and all can enjoy that. Most positional goods are asymmetrical, like being wealthier than other people requires that you're at a particular place in the pecking order. Are being number one or being above average, they're all positional, asymmetrically positional goods. Now, the thing about power is that it's asymmetrically positional. We can't all have power over others. I mean, give or take some things about domain, etc. But in the same domain, we can't each have power over others, because to have power over others is to have them be in a position where they've got to choose according to your will, regardless of what they want to do and regardless of what you want them to do. It's the old Lake Wobegon observation, right? Where, you know, the women are pretty, blah, 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 and all the children are above average. I mean, above average for Lake Wobegon, presumably, that is an impossibility. You can't, not everyone can have power. And that's what's, in a way, unsavory about power. So it's a positional competitive good that if we each seek, we've got to seek to put others down at the same time that we seek that good for ourselves. But anti-power, notice, is not in that way asymmetrically positional. We could each seek anti-power in relation to others. We could each have anti-power, say, in a given domain of choice, in relation to others. That would be to say that no others have power over us in that relevant domain of choice, that in that domain of choice we have anti-power insofar as we have shaping influence over what we choose, regardless of what we want to choose and regardless of what others in that domain want us to choose. Okay, that's what anti-power is, and anti-power, as I say, is more savory than power in that respect. Now, of course, with anti-power, as with power, though, notice that if I've got anti-power, it's got to be the case that I have a shaping influence over my choices, as I said, regardless of what I happen to want to do, and that includes regardless of my happening to want to do something that it's extremely unlikely I would want to do. I mean, let's suppose that we're talking about that'd be a choice of where you want to live. And let's suppose money isn't particularly an object within your budget constraint. You've got the anti-power vis-a-vis others that, regardless of what they want, that you should, let's suppose, that you should, regardless of what you want in regard to where you live and regardless of what they want in regard to where you should live, you can influence where you can live. So you can live either in, and I have a very rough idea of Oxford geography, despite having heard many times, you can live in Cowley or Oxford, right? Now, it might be extremely unlikely that you'd want to live in Oxford. I mean, extremely, you hate academics. You can't stand the sort of, you know, the aura of sanctity and learning around the place and all those damn gowns and so on swishing in front of you. I mean, it's so unlikely, it's unbelievably unlikely. But still, if you're going to have anti-power in this domain of where you want to live, it's important that for the very unlikely but possible scenario on which you want to live in Oxford, you should be able to shape your choice according to that taste, that very unlikely taste. So again, as with power, and indeed as with the examples we looked at the other day, what you want is an actualist good, in this case, the good of influencing your own choices in a shaping way. You want that actualist good, and you want it robustly, that's to say across various possibilities, variations, what you will, what the other person wants, that you will, and so on. And those various possibilities, those scenarios, many of them are extremely improbable. But that's what it is to have anti-power, that you have that actualist good in those even very unlikely sorts of scenarios. Now, it's worth, in discussing anti-power, which I've just introduced and defined, first of all, I take it that you all think it'd be quite a nice thing to have, really, in a certain domain, to have that sort of anti-power, not to be subject to the will of other people in this domain of choice, to be able to have a shaping influence on what you choose, independently of what they want you to choose, or indeed what you happen to want to choose. Sounds like a good thing. Now, it's interesting to compare it with non-interference, which is an equally robustly demanding good, I would say, as Berlin presents it. So let's go back to Rafe and me. Let's suppose Rafe enjoys non-interference in relation to me. What's that going to consist in? Well, according to, in a given domain of choice, this choice, that choice, another choice, according to Berlin, Rafe is going to enjoy... My apologies, dear man, you don't... I'm holding you up here today, but not in any hostile spirit, needless to say. Okay, so for him to enjoy non-interference in the domain of choice relative to me, what has to be the case is the following, according to Berlin, that for each of those choices, and each is described by a set of options, it has to be the case that regardless of what he wants to do in that choice, he can do it. Each door, in Berlin's terminology, has to be an open door. It's not enough for Rafe to enjoy non-interference, for example, that the actual choice he makes is one that I don't oppose. It has to be the case much more richly that even had he chosen the other option or another option in the choice, equally I wouldn't have opposed it. So he enjoys non-interference, it's robustly demanding, insofar as he enjoys influence over his own choices in this domain, regardless of what he happens to want. That's what's required for Berlinian non-interference. So what's the difference between anti-power and non-interference? Well, the difference, and I'm going on the strict definition, I actually think Berlin... this is going out on a limb, but I actually think Berlin is often concerned with what I call anti-power, even though he talks the language of non-interference. But strictly, here's what would be enough for non-interference, but would not be enough for anti-power. It might be the case that Rafe enjoys this this influence over his choices, regardless of what he wants to do in the relevant domain, because I'm really well disposed towards Rafe. I really want him to, you know, do what he wishes, you know, in this realm of choice. That's what I sort of want him to do. So that might be exactly why he enjoys this modally robust choice. But should I not want that he have his way, right? Then he would not, it's not required for non-interference in the actual world, that in the possible world where I have a different will towards him, where I'm less indulgent, that there also he not be opposed by me. It's enough for interference that there's actual non-frustration of what he chooses, and holding me fixed and my benevolence fixed, that there's non-frustration of what he might choose, the other options. But it's not required that this influence over his choices remain robust as my will changes. So the difference is, well, actually, let's look at the let's look at this again, the second and third lines. So antipar, this is actually the fourth line down strictly. I enjoy antipar. This now is in Rafe's voice. Rafe enjoys, I enjoy speaking for Rafe. Antipar, insofar as my choices, his choices, match my will over changes in both my will and your will. He's talking to me now. As a result of external constraints. Constraints on me, obviously. And what I get, therefore, what Rafe gets, is non-frustration in his choices over that range of changes in what he wants or what I want that he wants. And thereby he enjoys antipar. Now, for him to enjoy non-interference, actually, I've jumped a little bit here. That should be non-interference, not freedom as non-interference. We'll come to that in a moment. What is required is that his choices should match his will over changes in his will. The doors both have to be open. As a result of any factor, including just benevolence or indulgence on my part, so that he gets non-frustration, as things are, as I'm benevolent, over his choosing one or the other, but not over my wanting that he choose one or the other. It's assumed it'll be enough for non-interference that I'm indulgent. It will not be enough for antipar that I'm indulgent. Now, with those definitions, you can introduce an even more savoury good than antipar. Antipar, as I've described it, and non-interference is a bilateral relationship between Rafe and me. But now you might think of freedom as antipar, or as I called it time and again, freedom as non-domination, as requiring antipar against all others. In the society, I enjoy freedom as non-domination insofar as I enjoy antipar against all others, not just Rafe enjoys, not just against me, but against all others. He enjoys it in, let's say, a domain of choice that's identified as the relevant domain, say, of basic choices. We can perhaps come back to that in the discussion. It's an important issue. But you can see that freedom as non-domination is a sort of generalization of antipower. It's enjoying antipower in the same set of choices as others, so it's defined in the same way for everyone, in relation to all others. So in this domain of choice, regardless of what you want to choose, and regardless of what any others want that you should choose, still you influence your own choice. And notice the difference then with freedom as non-interference, which is also robustly demanding. I'm going to enjoy, Rafe's going to enjoy freedom as non-interference, given that for a relevant domain of choices, he can choose as he wills over variations in his will, but not regardless of what all others want that he wills. He can enjoy that just because they happen to be indulgent. That will still give him non-interference. So while it's robustly demanding, it means that he's got to be non-frustrated, even as he actually chooses, even given his actual taste or will, but also he should have it given he wills something else, so it's robustly demanding, but it's not as robustly demanding as freedom as non-domination, because it's enough for freedom as non-interference that Rafe should enjoy this because, let's suppose, of the goodwill or the benevolence or whatever of the many much more powerful people around him. They're very nice to him, and freedom as non-interference he'll certainly enjoy, but freedom as non-domination or freedom as antipar he won't enjoy. Now, there are parallel reasons, it seems to me, for preferring, on the one hand, freedom as non-interference to freedom as what I call non-frustration, and for preferring freedom as non-domination to freedom as non-interference. So Berlin, and I think this is one of his big contributions, actually, and I don't know that anyone else drew attention to it in the history of the discipline, but he pointed out that if freedom consisted, if having freedom of choice and a given choice between X and Y, consisted in not being frustrated, that's to say, consisted in not being opposed by others in the option you happen to choose. If it consisted just in that, he pointed out, and I think a very nice set of observations, that actually that would mean that you could make yourself free just by changing your preferences in many cases. So imagine I'm a prisoner, and I really want to live in the outside world. But, you know, those are the guards, and they're locking me up, you know, so I'm really frustrated. Now, Hobbes, by the way, who thought, do you remember the definition of a free man, is he that in those things that he's the strength and wit to do, to be able to do, and he is not hindered to do what he has a will to. You're only unfree if you're not hindered to do what you have a will to. That's to say, what you actually choose. But it doesn't matter if you might have been opposed in what you could have chosen, the other option. So you're free just as far as you're not frustrated. Berlin pointed out that that's not enough, or that that has this funny implication, that you can make yourself free in a very counterintuitive way in many circumstances. So you're in prison, you're locked up, you want to live outside, you hunger for the outside life. But, you know, you're not getting it, so you're unfree in the Hobbesian sense. But then it dawns on you one day, hey, I can make myself free, liberate myself, just by adapting my preferences. So you think about prison, you know, it's not so bad. You know, you've always got a roof over your head, regular meals, you know. You can read more or less what you like. You get a good night's sleep every night because the lights go out and so on, and that's good for you. Otherwise, you'd be tempted to leave the light on too long, read too late and so on. And, you know, you sort of can exercise and say, you can lift yourself. You can get really... And you'd think about it and think, geez, this isn't so bad, you know. And you end up wanting to be in prison. But now you're no longer frustrated because now the preference you have to live in prison is actually not being opposed and not being frustrated. And so you're perfectly free. And so you've made yourself free. That was his, I call it the anti-adaptation, so to speak, argument. None of us thinks that you could make yourself free in that sense. Now, we're talking discussion about other senses, but in the sense of giving yourself freedom of choice just by adapting your preferences, it seems all wrong. You've got to change the other guys, you know, if you're going to make yourself free and they've been opposing you, changing yourself. I mean, maybe some of the Stoics, you know, moved in that direction, and indeed Berlin maybe is picking that up, but he points out it's crazy to think you could make yourself free. Yet you could make yourself free by adaptation of preferences if freedom consisted just in not being frustrated. It seems to me there's a parallel argument, maybe not quite as overwhelming or anything, for why freedom as non-domination is at least better than freedom as non-interference. I'm not talking about that true meaning of freedom. I think that's a hopeless sort of task. And then it's the following one. Suppose that I have freedom as interference. Make it me now in relation to Professor Waldron there, right? He's the power. And let's suppose I've got freedom as non-interference in relation to him. Suppose that's all we want, I want just freedom as non-interference. Now, it turns out that actually in relation to him, I don't have it, let's suppose, because in a given choice, X and Y, you know, he really doesn't like me very much, and he has the power to, you know, at will, more or less without cost to himself, to stop me doing X or Y, depending indeed what I want to do. He may consistently frustrate me, so to speak. If freedom just consists in non-interference, if I could become free only if I could just manage to not be interfered with, that's to say to have robust non-frustration regardless of what I will, then I could really make myself free by sucking up, by ingratiation rather than adaptation. You know, so I do the Rigoletto in relation to the dukes, you know, sort of thing, the people at the court, the courtiers. I sort of, you know, I believe, of course, I tell him how wonderful he is and his work is and so on, but okay, let's move away from journalism. This is not a role which is fair to cast anyone in let alone his dear friends. Okay, so you know, I could make myself free just by really, doing the toadying and fawning and all the traditional sorts of wiles of it, self-ingratiation. I get him really to like me, you know. And hey, you know, he says, Pettit's not so bad, you know, so I feel pretty good when Pettit's around, you know. So at that stage, suddenly he turns good, he's indulgent towards me. And now it means I do have a choice between doing X and Y in their relevant domain, regardless of what I will, because now he's turned indulgent. So freedom would just require non-interference. That's to say, robustness of self-influence across variations in your own will. Then you could make yourself free just by making all the wills of the powerful around you sweet towards you. And it seems to me, and there's a long tradition, of course, of underlining this, that it's sort of sick to think that you could make yourself free by ingratiating, by toadying and fawning and all that sort of thing. Because you're not putting constraints on other people. They're the ones. I depend on the will of these other people, the powerful people, and just by sucking up to them, you know, sweetening their will, that's not a way of making yourself free of that constraint on you intuitively. But if you thought of freedom as just requiring non-interference, it would be. So just as Berlin argues that if you thought about freedom as just non-frustration, you could make yourself free in this counterintuitive way by simply adapting your preferences appropriately. So this argument goes, if with Berlin you thought that freedom just required non-interference, then you could make yourself free in the relevant range of choices by sweetening up, you know, all those other people who otherwise might have who have the power of interfering with you. Now, just one line, and then we'll... I just make this comment, which, because it hasn't been clear in what I've written, and I think I'm culpable for that, though I don't think anything I wrote was inconsistent with it, but the observation I want to make is this. Consistently with thinking that you are rendered unfree insofar as someone dominates you, that has a power of interference over you that's not externally constrained, consistently with thinking that, you might think, hey, but it's much better to be dominated without being interfered with. For example, let's suppose Nick picks someone else just to spread the ignominy. Let's suppose that Nick has this power over me. I've lost my line of thought. Yes, he dominates me. That's to say, he's indulgent towards me, but if he turned bad, if he turned hostile, he could actually stop me doing various things. But he doesn't actually. He's quite friendly. That's a much better scene than if, so to speak, he, for certain choices I make, was prepared to stop me. I mean, he mightn't frustrate me because it might happen that everything I chose was what he wanted me to do, but he would stop me if I did other things. Better have freedom as not, better have domination without interference than domination with interference, and equally better have interference without frustration, you know, interference with an option you don't actually want, than have interference with frustration, have actual opposition to an option you do want. So you kind of grades of, well, I would say actually of freedom, that freedom as that domination in itself is less of an affront to freedom than domination plus interference, which is less of an affront than domination plus interference plus frustration. But maybe that's getting a little technical. It's just I'm really covering my back, you know, because of various things that may be raised in discussion. Okay, now I want to make some more remarks about why freedom is still, in this sense, is desirable. Indeed, both sorts of freedom, as non-domination and non-interference, are desirable. I think freedom as non-domination is more desirable. And how, indeed, it can be delivered into people's hands, how they can come to enjoy this particular good. Well, first of all, one question, and it's analogous to a question I raised yesterday, and indeed, I think with Jonathan, I don't think I responded, as I thought about it this morning, adequately to your observation yesterday. But here's a question about the state, about why I desire freedom. Freedom is non-domination, I'm talking about. Freedom is non-domination now is going to consist in, well, it's natural to call a status, I suppose, a status which has the following effect. It's a protected status, right? Which has the following effect, that across a range of variations in what you want to do and in what other people want that you should do within a relevant domain of choice, Brown might call it a basic choices here. It consists in having a status, which means that across those variations, you actually continue to have a shaping influence on what you choose yourself. You're not subject to anybody else's influence across that range of variations. Okay, so now one question is, it might be the case that across that range of variations, other people do not actually have an influence on me. I continue to influence myself in those choices, but that comes about not because I'm protected, but for some other reason. So, for example, to go a little to the side, you remember Groucho Marx's quip that he wouldn't want to join a club that would have him as a member, right? Imagine that there is a power in my life who dominates me, so it seems, in the sense that should he will that I do something, rather than he'd be able to enforce that on me. But here's a funny thing about this guy. He's a bit like Groucho Marx in relation to me. He's the sort of person such that for any occasion where he could interfere, he, as it were, bizarrely, has no desire to interfere. He only has a desire to interfere with people when he's resisted, when he can't interfere. He's like Groucho Marx, only wants to belong to a club that won't have him as a member. So this sort of power in my life, let's suppose, only wants to interfere with me or with anyone else, provided he's resisted. Now, of course, that's going to mean that across a range of variations in what I want to desire, he's never going to interfere with me in those cases, right? Regardless of what I will, even though he's all this power, because in all those cases, he can interfere with me, but that's no fun. He doesn't want to interfere with me, even if he can interfere with me. He's got this Groucho Marx sort of mentality. Now, obviously, at least I think, what I desire when I desire freedom is not just that people have this quirky psychology, right? So it's not just that people not interfere with me across this range of variations, changes in my will as to what I should do, changes in their will as to what I should do. I want to be protected against that, a specific sort of protection. I want there to be blocks of some kind in place against this, not just that it be the result of a quirky psychology. So in that sense, I say, I want this status, this relation to other people that shows up in the fact that I will not be subject to their influence. I'll be subject to my own influence across this range of variations. So it's not just that I want that range of self-influence across those variations, regardless of how it's produced, even produced by the quirky psychology. I want the actual status or relationship to others that will have that as a result. Okay, now why would I want that status in relation to others? In particular, why would I want that status, given that, let's suppose, another person is very unlikely to turn against me? Suppose I think that there's only one power in my life, and she is really nice, right? She's really kindly, well-disposed towards me. The chances of her turning hostile to me are very, very slight. So why would I worry about being entrenched, indeed by external constraints, against her interference in my life that possibility, given that I think it's extremely unlikely? And yet, by my definition, if I desire anti-power in relation to her, more generally, if I desire freedom as non-domination, I want her and everybody else, regardless of how generally well-disposed they are towards me, not to be able, in the event of their turning hostile, however unlikely, to actually subvert me and make it the case that I don't influence my own choice. And my answer is exactly as it was yesterday, that I think this is written very deeply into human psychology. I think that when we deal with one another, we ascribe capacities to one another, capacities to do this, to do that. We think of choices, of course, as options, things that are doable. And we think of an agent, if we think of an agent as properly an agent, we think of the agent as someone who can do this or who can do that. Now, we may think it's very unlikely that they can do Y, let's suppose, of X and Y, and let's suppose Y is interfere with me. We may think that it's very, very unlikely, because they like me so much, that they will do Y. But so long as we think of them as an agent, we can't ignore the fact that they can do Y. And that shows up in the fact even though we think it's really, really likely that they'll do X, which is nice for us, not interfere with us, it's still the case that when they do X, we think gratitude is in place. You feel grateful, you know? And equally, you feel resentment in the counterpart cases. And that's to say, we hold on to a view of other agents, even though they display a pattern, I think they're completely predictable. You know, man, they're really just probabilistic devices and you've got to track. You know how they're going to go. But if you think of the other person as an agent, if you think of them the way that goes with having reactive attitudes, that's to say, relief or resentment or gratitude, indignation, approval in response to them, then you think of them, that's part of being human in relation to others, as having that, well, you might call it incentive free will. A will to do this or that, that they can do regardless of the incentives that are before them. And insofar as that's true, you don't want to be subject to the will of another person, no matter how nice you think that will is, no matter how probable you think it is that that will always be friendly towards you. I mean, actually, that's now picking up an old theme, isn't it? We have the notion of being subject to the will of another. Kant, actually, I read recently in his commentary, his notes written after reading Rousseau's Social Contract, talks about two evils. One is the evil of being subject to natural necessity. You know, having that tornado. Did it strike in Princeton today, by the way? There really was a warning of a tornado in Princeton. We hope not. But that's one. That's really bad to be subject to that sort of possibility or probability, whatever. But he says it's so much worse to be subject to the will of another person, right? Even if the other person is likely to be nice to you, just being subject to their will. It's not that you're subject to a probable interference, it's that you're subject to an accessible interference, an agent accessible interference. And that's why we really like this status in which we are protected against the vagaries of the will of another person, no matter how unlikely it is that those vagaries would take that person into a hostile attitude towards you. Okay, so that's why I think we think of freedom as desirable. It's important, as it is in the other cases I argued yesterday, that we're dealing with human beings that we cast in this agential mode, human beings as centres of will that can never be, as it were, just treated as possible systems with possible trajectories and probabilities written in of choice. We treat them, they always, and we do not want to be subject to the will of another, which we conceive of in that way. Okay, now finally, on the delivery of freedom. So I've said that this is a great good that we enjoy at one another's hands when we enjoy this status, this freedom. Just as I said yesterday, to enjoy love or friendship or honesty or justice at the hands of others is a great good. And as I said yesterday, that others give us that good just by being virtuous, just by being internally constrained in the way we associate with virtue. So what I want to say here today is that what can give each of us this freedom as non-domination is the laws, basically. And where I understand the laws as being not the expression of a potentially dominating will, but being the expression of something else. If we collectively can have what in the tradition, of course, is called an empire of law, you know, a regime under which each of us is protected in a relevant domain, it has to be inclusive, I mean by each of us, is protected in a relevant domain of choice, a basic domain of choice, against the influence of others, the frustration of our choices by others, regardless of what we want to do in that domain, regardless of what they want that we want to do in that domain, how can we be given that good? Well, the only way, someone might say, by the benevolent despot. Let's suppose you've got the benevolent despot who puts down the laws and so on, and there it is, you're protected against everybody else. Well, yes, except the benevolent despot, because he's the centre of will, right? And you're all subject to him or her or them or whatever it might be. So the benevolent despot is no solution, nor is a sort of, what did I call it here in these handouts, a sort of philanthropic plutocracy. Imagine that, so to speak, there were some people who were really wealthy. You know, they could swagger, they could do anything they liked to the rest of us. But they're sort of benign and they realize, you know, that by abdicating this power, so to speak, but not a jury, not an announcement, but by just not choosing to exercise it. Actually, everybody, and they themselves, are even perhaps better off. But it's still the case for each of us in various relationships. We're always going to be subject to the will of these people, however malign they are. So that won't give us freedom as non-domination. That won't give us the generalized version of what I called antipower. So what might give us? Well, and I don't say there's an easy solution to this, though I've been spending much of the last year on that particular topic. A design under which the laws did protect us and the laws were not subject to a potentially alien will of that kind. Now, of course, Rousseau thought that that problem would be solved by the notion of the general will. I don't go with that at all, and I think that was actually a departure from a longer, more mainline tradition of thinking about what an empire of law would be. Now, I'm going to say very much more about this here, but let me just state, confess my belief rather than defend it, which is that we can have a regime under which we each have an equal share in controlling how laws are made, where that equal share consists not just in an equal share in the collective contestation of how the laws are made that is associated with elections, for example, but equally consists in having an individualized power of contestation, and where there's some notion of a sort of contestatory equilibrium whereby we accept standards in common across the society, and the regime of contestability means that the laws are forced to conform to these standards that we, each of us, uphold. If you could have something that answered to that specification, then I think you would have laws that do not reflect the will of any individual or any elite, any clique, even a majority, if you can think of a majority as an agent, but are controlled in a way by each of us in such a way that none of us can complain about the sort of control in question, and that sort of empire of law can protect each of us against others. Now, of course, in just gesturing at the institutional demands for such a regime of contestability, it really is just a gesture, and I think that that's, you know, what democratic theory and constitutional theory in part is about, is trying to fit in the sorts of institutions that would meet that specification. But just to give you a very sort of down-to-earth example, think of how people discipline one another into behaving as they behave in a well-formed queue, the sort of queue you regularly find, certainly, in England, right? And in actually most countries, it seems to me. Now, we all, I would say, of course, we've got special interests, but as people who maybe in this queue or that queue or the other queue, et cetera, were competing and there's time, et cetera, a bit short, we all have an interest in there being a formal system of queuing whereby you don't jump queue. And notice how the queuing discipline is sustained. I suspect it's in great part sustained by the fact that everybody knows that if they move out of line, you know, and try to jump up, you know, even if other people don't say anything, they're really going to think, this is a complete wretch, you know. And you can't say anything with cars that are queuing. And, you know, the car that zooms up on the inside lane, you know, you really need a very tough mentality to do that. It seems to me we're all policed by the expectation that we will be condemned and disapproved of if we behave in another way. That's a sense in which we all, so to speak, impose, in this case, a norm rather than a law on each of us. And indeed, it's a law that gives each of us a domain of choice, as you might say, in which we are protected. I just to give you some idea of what I have in mind by a rule of law that might not express a dominating will. That's what we would need to give us, it seems to me, freedom as non-domination. And now let me finally just come back to the lesson for law, which is analogous, in a way, to the lesson for virtue. I said that on the basis of what I argued yesterday, you might think that virtue isn't good just insofar as it prompts people to do good things or primes them on what good things require, what would be good to do, but means that virtues in themselves are a source of real good, this robustly demanding good, of an entrenched goodwill that we enjoy at one another's hands. Similarly, I want to say something about law that's parallel. People talking about why laws are good often say one of two things. One is that, well, having the laws there, you know, with the sanctions attached and so on, it makes it more likely that people will do what they ought to do anyhow, assuming the laws aren't nefarious in any way. So, for example, the sanction on perjury makes it more likely that people in that context will tell the truth. The sanction on dishonesty, fraud, and so on make it more likely that they will, in various exchanges, you know, behave in what we all think is the proper way. That is certainly one benefit of law. A second benefit is that law signals, good law signals, how, by common perceptions, we ought to behave. It's exactly like the prompting and priming function of virtue. You get a sort of prompting and priming function of law. But if this is right, then law, like virtue, also delivers a third sort of good. And it does it just by being there, by the very fact that the laws are there, that you are protected, that these, you know, resistance field, this resistance field for each of us is set up against others, and of course it's maintained democratically by our participation in the institutions that sustain the law. But just by being there, those laws mean we enjoy a great good, that good of not being dominated, of being free in the sense of being able to choose subject to our own influence across variations in our will and in other people's wills of what we should do in the relevant domain. Hell of a bumper sticker that, you know. Okay, so that I think of now as the prime good that the law delivers into our hands. And let me finally mention one implication of that, just to try to underline why this isn't an utterly vapid sort of conclusion. Think of Kant on the Kingdom of Ends. Now, in the Kingdom of Ends, you know, I haven't checked the text, I may get it slightly wrong, apologies to the scholars, but roughly like this. In the Kingdom of Ends, everyone is really moral. They're disposed to behave really well towards other people, right? They are of real goodwill towards other people. And the suggestion often is that in a Kingdom of Ends, you wouldn't need law, right? Because people wouldn't need to be prompted to do good, they're prompted anyhow. And they wouldn't need law to signal what goodness requires, because their goodwill and insight tells them what goodness requires of them. But I say that in the Kingdom of Ends, there'd be something missing. Because it would still be the case, from the point of view of each of us, now, this partly depends on moral psychology in the background, but it'd still be the case that should other people turn ill will towards us, should other people depart from the high virtue which they're currently on, in that scenario, any one of us might be subject indeed to the influence of another in our choices. So we're hostage to others. We're not protected in the way in which we would be if there were laws also in place. Now, if there are laws also in place in the Kingdom of Ends, what you'd expect is they'd not be necessary. That's true in the sense that they'd not be triggered, because no one would have to be sanctioned. They'd all be so good. But the existence of law in itself would mean that we have this good, this status in relation to others, that's so important to us. This status in relation to others will normally, if we have it by virtue of law, be a matter that's manifest to us and manifest to others that it's manifest to us and manifest to each that it's manifest to all. It'll be a matter of common knowledge. And when you enjoy not just freedom as non-domination, but that conscious freedom as non-domination, that's what I think of enjoying in the title of Jeremy's recent book or forthcoming book, Dignity. I think of that as dignity, when you have that status vis-a-vis others, a protected status as a matter of common knowledge, so you can look others in the eye, knowing that they know that you are proof or close to proof against their worst intentions, against their hostility should they turn hostile. And I would say, finally, that something we think of as respect that you might enjoy, respect in the sense in which you can't get it without commanding it. When you're protected against others, not just by the laws and not just as a matter of common knowledge, but also by others now internalizing this and actually having a goodwill towards you, then I think that's the full blossom, so to speak, the full flower. That's what it is to enjoy the standing of respect in your society. But notice, law is at the center, and it's the existence of laws, not just laws prompting us to do well or laws priming us on what we should do. It's laws just being there as a protector that provides us with that good. I'm sorry for going on so long. Thank you.